And now for a segment called Just Something I've Noticed, brought to you by our friends at Motel 6. Just Something I've Noticed. There's a lot more yawning these days. Have you noticed that? Yeah. And the bad thing about yawning, it's contagious. Now, I'm not a scientist, but I do know that's true. You see somebody else yawn, all of a sudden, you got to yawn. Do you know what helps to curtail the yawning? How about a great night's rest at Motel 6? Book online at motel6.com. Use the code CPREDEye to get 15% off your stay at Motel 6 or Studio 6. With almost 1,500 locations across the country, there's almost always a Motel 6 or Studio 6 nearby. And truck parking is available at most locations. Enjoy a clean, comfortable room at a price you will love when you use the code CPREDEye. That's the letters CPREDEye, all one word, for 15% off your stay at Motel 6. And help curtail the yawning. That's just something I've noticed. Brought to you by Motel 6.
Now, it's Red Eye Radio. Gary McNamara and Eric Harley talk about everything from politics to social issues and news of the day. Whether you're up late or you're just starting your day, welcome to the show. This is Red Eye Radio.
Hello and welcome. He is Gary McNamara. I'm Eric Harley as we begin a Monday. The Oscars after party continues live on Red Eye Radio. Coming up, we'll talk with our guests.
Yeah, I hear. The after party is, the booze is free, right?
Is it?
Yes, but the cocaine is not. Are they still doing cocaine in Hollywood? I have no idea.
I have no idea.
I wasn't blaming anybody of doing anything. I was just asking a question. It was just a joke. And it's probably not free.
I am told that within the first, my old producer, Leafy, wrote me. He said he predicted that there would be a, you know, because of Top Gun Maverick. He said, I was, 50 seconds, I figured would be the first Scientology joke. And he said it was within the first minute. He goes, I was right. Because of Tom Cruise. Now, I didn't hear. I have never heard of any of the movies that won. Not one except Top Gun Maverick won for sound. And as I just told you a couple of minutes ago, that is well deserved. And the reason is,
they had sound? It wasn't a silent movie?
It was not a silent movie.
Oh.
But as I told you, in my home theater system, I just got a new app.
Yeah.
Which lets me, on the app, control the sound coming out of the back speakers individually and completely, just totally precise. So I got it like Thursday and it's decided to check it out on Friday.
Right.
So I had bought, just because so many people wanted to watch it, I bought Top Gun Maverick back. Was it last, when did it come out, last summer, fall, whenever it came out?
Yeah, I don't remember.
And so I could have so my dad could watch it too, because my dad's a former pilot. So I decided, well, if I'm going to check in on a movie, that's the one to check in on, right?
Sure, right.
So it's just a scene where they're at like the Air Force base, but he's just talking. And, you know, there's jets flying overhead.
Is it Air Force or Navy?
Navy, I'm sorry, Navy. Yeah, okay. I'm going to say Air Force Navy. Yeah. Thank you very much, yes, Top Gun. And so, as Cruise is talking, I hear a jet, and it starts right like in front of my nose,
right,
goes all the way around my head, and comes right back again, and then, you know, takes off. Does a complete 360, and it was, again, ambient sound. It wasn't. It was background sound, and it was just awesome. And I went, they should win for sound on that one, because that was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So,
especially if they had speakers. A note from the directors. This movie will require speakers.
Yeah, so let's talk about the Oscars. I don't know any of the movies. Okay, move on. What else is going on?
Yeah,
any banks crash?
I'll say this. Congratulations to the winners and to the losers. It was an honor just to be nominated. or slapped. Was anybody slapped? Nobody was slapped?
Not, I have, you know, I didn't. I woke up and I woke up to, you know, Janet Yellen saying no bailout.
Yeah, right.
And I, and it's like no bailout, yet we're going to protect all the depositors past $250,000. And immediately, I mean, I've just been reading everything I possibly can because there is a small possibility that might be the case after they liquidate all the assets. Because it's predicted that the assets that the bank had
might
be 95% of the might be 95% of
make the, up 95% of the deposits.
Of the deposits, right.
Yes, right. Yeah. Yeah. Because they weren't out of the bank wasn't out of capital, they were out of cash. They had assets.
Right.
Have assets.
And so but still and she didn't necessarily mention that. That I forgot where I've been reading so many publications here, but somebody brought that up. That might be the case, but they may not be able to get that type of money, whatever the assets are or the accounts are. They may not be able to get that. But still, if that's the case, if that's the most optimistic case, the taxpayer will still get dinged.
Mm-hmm.
And she simply said, well, no, we're just going to take it out of the Federal Deposit Insurance company, and we'll charge all banks more, and that fee will pay for this. Which means we'll pay more, right. Bank fees will go up, so you are.
Yeah.
But the fact is that it may be directly for taxpayers because they're saying that's not what the law says.
Right, regarding the FDIC.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And so banks to charge them higher fees, they may sue immediately saying, we had nothing to do.
Wait, that's not on us.
That's not on us. That's on you.
Right.
And then there's the, very quickly, I mean, if because it gets pretty complicated when you talk about this, and the first thing you said was, saw on Friday, the first thing I saw was Trump's fault. It's like.
Well, of course. Yeah.
No, this has nothing to do with.
No.
This has nothing to do with Trump. But I guess it's basically easy that. There were so many deposits, and add in any time you want, because, again, I'm still, when these things happen, it's like what you hear the first couple of days, there may be a twist on it later on down the road.
Mm-hmm.
But there were so many deposits to this bank that they could not lend out safely enough money, and so they were loaded with cash. They took that cash, and they put it into long duration fixed income assets in order to make more of a profit. They don't want to put it in the federal government because rates were so low.
Mm-hmm.
And so as the interest rate went up, these assets became less valuable and less valuable. And they would have tremendous losses if they were forced to liquidate these assets before, you know, maturity.
Mm.
And that's exactly what happened.
Well, and there was
they started once they started going after the money, or once that started, well, then they didn't have, you know, they were taking huge losses as they were trying to sell things, and then boom.
Well, and the depositors actually were drawing down their balances because over the last year and a half, you had a number of tech companies that were not getting capital investors the way they had. They weren't getting those kinds of loans for their business operations and projects. And as they had to use their own money, they were drawing down those deposits that they had in Silicon Valley Bank. And as they draw those down, that starts to look worse, of course, on the balance sheet. Draws down on, of course, the lending power of any bank when that happens. And then when that got out, then you had a number of companies and individuals who basically kind of started the run on the real run on the bank.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it ended up being over the last week or so. The scenes at Silicon Valley Bank outside the one main location is kind of reminiscent of It's a Wonderful Life. I mean, there were people at the door asking where their money is. And many of those people are the creators of startups. They have, you know, these companies that they run. But this was the big tech. I won't say, you know, big tech bank, but it was the tech bank, 16th largest bank. And
second biggest bank failure.
Yeah, it's, you know, and if you go back to the WaMu failure, you know, when that collapsed, you know, wow, that was 2008, September 2008. And, you know, that was about way too much bad mortgage paper on their balance sheets. And, you know, again, it was just it was one of those implosions. WaMu had transitioned from a savings and loan, Washington Mutual, I'm sorry, for those that may not know them, as that. And then eventually, as they collapsed, then Chase took over their assets. And there could be a takeover here. I don't know who's buying, I guess is the is the point. Washington Mutual was a different type of setting. The question would be, how much does this say about the degradation, the slowing down, the downward trend of big tech? Is it as much, does it, you know, a friend of mine actually had a conversation. He's in finance, and we had a conversation over the weekend, and he kind of phrased it that way, basically implying this is as much of a message about or indicator about big tech as it is the problem with some of the banks that are out there. And could it be, I noticed the mainstream media jumped on it and really wanted to go down the road of this is not indicative of the entire banking system. Well, I didn't see anybody claiming that it was. So they kind of brought a straw man argument to the articles, but I saw it in a few different places. I thought that was kind of weird. I guess maybe they were trying to just temper the fears of any readers or listeners. And you look at that and, you know, you ask the question, because this is not like the mortgage meltdown.
No, it's different.
But the tech meltdown is real, but I just don't think it's going to play out. It's not. You know, this is not the, you know, Silicon Valley Bank was unique in that way. Well, no bank was unique if it carried mortgage paper, you know, back in right. 2008.
Let me ask you this. Is it more reminiscent of the dot-com bubble?
But, you know, but, I thought but, about that. Yeah.
But particular yeah. to one bank or a few banks.
I would say that it, and I don't know to what extent the other banks, you know, may have any liabilities here or, you know, may be on the brink. But no, I think it is. The difference in this is a second dot-com bubble bursting. I don't know if it is what it was at the end of the 90s, though. The 90s, they had built right. up a lot of things based on what could happen in the future, right? This mm-hmm. is what these things are going to be, you know? People weren't tech savvy. We didn't have social media. We didn't have so much information available. Even though we had the internet, no one really knew what – I'm talking about the common person. No one really knew what to do with it or how it was going to play a role. I don't think businesses had fully realized or capitalized on the potential of the internet at that time. When I came to this job in 96, we only had the internet in one room in the entire building. And so when you look at that, that was more of, okay, we kind of built it up bigger than where we are at the moment. So they hit the brakes on it. That's just kind of my assessment on it. Then you look at where we are right now. It's kind of the same thing with a number of items along the way. There are tech companies out there that were testing things that they thought were going to really take off, and they didn't really take off. Innovations they thought they were going to implement into their business model that didn't pan out. And some of that has to do with, in fact, I'd say a lot of it has to do with, to some extent, COVID and the ability to launch things in a normal setting. But I would also say that COVID presented a ton of opportunities for tech companies because people became, the end user became more tech savvy and then became, changed their habits as such to use that technology to assist in their daily lives. So, you know, I think it's kind of a wash in that regard. I just don't know that I see this mm-hmm. as a tech bubble like the end of the 90s.
I would say, like I said, extremely focused one, but not the same reason. Not the same reason as a dot-com bubble, which was a ton of capital going in to those companies.
Ahead of the return.
Ahead of a return,
yeah.
Which never came to fruition.
Yeah, and I would say the biggest headwinds right now that could be much bigger than what they faced in the dot-com bubble before are the regulatory concerns for big tech. I think there's a ton of stuff right now, not just in the States, but they've already started in Europe. And I think there's going to be a lot of that. This calling for break up the big tech companies or whatever, just regulation, massive regulation is on the way. And both sides of the aisle here in the States and in Europe are on board for it more and more. So it's going to happen. It's just a matter of when.
I think later on today you're going to hear the screaming that this is a bailout.
Well, no. I mean, if it ends up being at the foot of the taxpayer, there's no way, right. other way to, you know, to put it. Yeah.
We'll talk more about this coming up. 866-90 Red Eye.
It's not always easy to spring back from the harsh days of winter to warmer months ahead. From de-icing chemicals to hidden debris underneath snow and ice, winter conditions can do serious damage to your truck. Here's a must-do maintenance check to help you minimize downtime and stay rolling. Have your batteries tested and inspect your electrical system for any exposed connections, wires, or butt connectors. Get any exposed components repaired immediately, as the acidic nature of highway de-icers will erode any exposed connections or wires in no time at all. This report is brought to you by Shell Rotella. Shell Rotella, with advanced synthetic technology, is designed to help keep your rig running with more mileage and less maintenance.
Get in touch with Red Eye Radio, toll free at 866-90-RED-EYE.
It's Red Eye Radio. He's Eric Harley, and I'm Gary McNamara. 866-90 Red Eye. We'll continue talking more about the bank failure. Now, two bank failures. Because the other bank was it Signature Bank. So we'll get to the specifics on that, and in fact, whether it's a bailout or not. And interestingly enough, the $250,000 really their limit on the FDIC is to protect the small person.
Well, that's it because many of the depositors in Silicon Valley Bank had well over $250,000 in deposits.
Oh, yeah. Hundreds of millions.
When you look at the average depositor of a what I would call a consumer bank, I mean, technically SVB was a consumer bank, but if you talk about Bank of America or Chase or maybe your local bank, the majority of deposits are not deposits over $250,000. And so that's it. When they started drawing their money, their deposits out, the bank had to start selling its own assets in order to cover those deposits or the withdrawals.
At a massive loss.
And they had to do so at a pretty big loss. And then, of course, when they were downgraded by, you know, people that were investors, it was like, you know, saying, oh, you can't keep doing this. This isn't going to fly. Then all of a sudden, that's when it really, really hit. And that's when the real run on Silicon Valley.
And happened. The fact is, like other banks, regular banks, the deposits are much more diversified, too.
Yeah, right. Yep.
And so that was one of the problems. So we'll get to more on that coming up. Plus, also, putting your non-binary pronouns on your resume does not help.
Yeah.
New study out. The White House non-committal right now on that bill that would declassify COVID, the origins of COVID-19.
Mm-hmm.
The intelligence we have, it would declassify it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the last time that you had every single member of the Senate and every single member of the House, Democrat and Republican, Independent, Socialist, all vote to declassify,
right.
And the White House won't say
right.
after the House voted whether the president will do that or not.
Right.
Plus, is the president going against his promise to liberals on oil drilling?
Oh,
you saw that story,
yeah.
right? We'll get to that and more coming up.
And now for a segment called Just Something I've Noticed, brought to you by our friends at Motel 6. Just something I've noticed. Bargain hunting is back. I mean, bargain hunting's always been around. We always love a great deal. But man, everywhere you look, people are bargain hunting. You know, there's so many great ways to find great deals. Hey, I have a great find in your bargain hunting journey. Book online at motel6.com. Use the code CPRedEye to get 15% off your stay at Motel 6 or Studio 6. With almost 1,500 locations across the country, there's almost always a Motel 6 or Studio 6 nearby, and truck parking is available at most locations. Enjoy a clean, comfortable room at a price that's a real bargain when you use the code CPRedEye. That's the letters CPRedEye, all one word, for 15% off your stay at Motel6.com. That is a bargain. That's just something I've noticed. Brought to you by Motel 6.
What's up, everyone? It's Reality Steve, your number one source for all things Bachelor Nation and reality TV. Every day, I'm giving you the behind-the-scenes juice and your info on all your Bachelor Nation stories and also interviewing some of your favorite reality stars. My name has been synonymous with spoilers, but I'm so much more than that. Give me a listen.
The Reality Steve Podcast, part of the Believe Network. Just search BLEAV on YouTube or wherever you listen.
Gary McNamara and Eric Harley taking your calls. 1-866-90-RED-EYE.
And he is Eric Harley, and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90-RED-EYE. Some things to think about in these bank failures. Well, one was reading the Wall Street Journal that said the majority of time in these cases, let me just get it here. The Fed say they were guaranteed. They will guarantee even the uninsured deposits at SVB as well as Signature Bank in New York. Typically, in a bank, those depositors would get their money back, even the ones over $250,000, with the 15 to 20% haircut. This would no doubt be a hardship for many customers, but the $250,000 limit is known. We know what that is.
No, you know that going in.
Will the universal uninsured deposit guarantee be next? Because this is what I'm thinking. Does this set up another bubble when you set a precedent that extremely rich venture capitalists taking an extreme risk have their investments and their deposits guaranteed by the federal government?
Right.
Does that become the new standard?
Well, then
what the hell's going to happen if that becomes the new standard?
Well, yeah, right after we pay off their college loans, we bail them out when their bank goes down, right?
Yep. This would be a monumental policy surrender, I'm reading from the Wall Street Journal, essentially admitting that the regulatory machinery established in 2010 by Dodd-Frank failed. We may be the only people in the world who still worry about moral hazard, but a nationwide guarantee for uninsured deposits, even for a limited time, means this will become the default policy anytime there is financial panic. There's also the question of legality, which we brought up, of such a guarantee. The FDIC created a transaction account guarantee program amid the 2008 pandemic, but Congress let it expire in Dodd-Frank. Congress set the $250,000 insured limit to protect average Americans, not venture investors in Silicon Valley. The FDIC may have resorted to its systemic risk exception for SVB and Signature, but this is a stretch considering their size. The joint statement by regulators said it received the required two-thirds vote of both the FDIC and the Fed boards. We'd like to see the creative legal work by the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department. The Fed is acting as it should be the provider of liquidity for all comers, but it's going further and offering one-year loans to banks against collateral of treasuries and other fixed income assets. The Fed will value these assets at par, which means banks don't have to sell their assets at a loss. The Fed is essentially guaranteeing bank assets that are taking a loss because banks took duration risk that Fed policies encouraged. This, too, is a bailout.
By the way, you mentioned Dodd-Frank. Barney Frank of Dodd-Frank is on the board for Signature Bank. And said he's one that they interviewed. He said they had a run of billions of dollars alone on Friday. Just Friday alone, Signature had a run. They had way too much invested in crypto. It was way too much.
Oh, yeah, yeah, and I saw was, that, yeah.
And so, you that, know, when
the
you,
Signature Bank.
Yeah, Signature
right,
Bank.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Right. And so when it's the problem with all that is, think about this. Let's pay off their college loans, right? And then when they're, you know, when their tech companies that they start going downhill, and then subsequently the banks that are created to, you know, facilitate the money can't survive because it's also all going downhill. We should just bail them all out. What we need is a song, like, you know, We Are the World, you know, where all the celebrities get together and help raise money for these rich individuals who are going to lose money. Look, this is a risk anytime you invest in anything. And when you deposit money and you know only $250,000 is guaranteed through FDIC, then you're going to have to diversify and you're going to have to choose where you're going to put those deposits. You're going to have to choose carefully. That's the way it's always been. If we're going to bail them out simply because, and this goes back to 2008. Remember, not all the banks were on the brink of being insolvent back then. It was only a few of them. But they decided, well, there would be a run on those banks and then all would fail. So they put money in the tills of all the banks, which made everybody wonder what the hell's going on. It muddied the waters for everybody. We couldn't see who was solvent, who wasn't, who to do business with, who to trust. And we stayed there trolling along the bottom in our economy for years. And if you're going to treat this like, oh, well, no, they should get their money. We'll make sure they get their money. Not my money. Then why not everybody that lost money on Bitcoin? Line them up. Go ahead and give them back what they lost on Bitcoin. No.
Yeah. And what you set up, I mean, this is if doing this, you set up, because this is the whole point. Well, the whole system will crumble if SVB and Signature go under. And it's like, no, they won't. Mm-hmm. There may be a run on some banks, but it will come back because most banks, the situation with most banks right now is that they're very well capitalized. In the United States, there is no chance, many believe, those opposed to it in the economic sector, look at this and say, yeah, there's going to be some hardship. There'll be some hardship in the tech sector. Yeah, there'll be more people now worried about, new tech startups.
Mm-hmm.
And venture capitalists will have to be more careful about how they invest their
because that's really, if you look at the SVB side, the venture capitalism was drawing down. It was like they were hitting the brakes because there were a lot of headwinds for big tech. So those companies, those people with deposits in Silicon Valley Bank, they had to go and they were using their money, which wouldn't have been typically that's not that big of a deal. That's not really a run on the bank when it happens over a year, year and a half. It's just a drawdown of deposits. But when the bank itself has its assets in things that are upside down, they've got to sell that for a loss in order to facilitate those drawdowns and those deposits, then now there is where, and you know, a lot of people have looked at it, and this is where it's, I think, very similar to the tech bubble of the late 90s. You know, a lot of people will tell you, well, the whole crypto thing isn't real. A lot of this stuff in tech is built on this euphoria. And you can say that about someone like Sam Bankman-Fried, SBF. Here's a guy who had convinced everybody it was cool. He wears board shorts in the boardroom. He plays by his own rules.
Sure did.
He plays video games while he's on a call.
I'm impressed.
He doesn't have to comb his hair. He's cool. He's the future.
Well, hey, could you switch my 401k over?
Exactly. It's a fraud. Oh, no, but he's got celebrities on board. Okay. Yeah, well, celebrities always do the right thing. So, count me in. Here's all my money.
Oh, I heard them last night. I mean, they seem to be very moral and concerned with everybody's welfare.
Right. Yes. They make all the right choices. And that's the way that a lot of tech and crypto, I would encompass crypto, the entire ball of crypto in that. But that's the way tech, too, has been treated over the years. You know, there's great innovation that brings about an expansion of wealth. Technology has done, I don't know how much for our economy, not just here domestically, but globally. The advent of the smartphone was massive. It changed the world. It changed how we do business. It changed how we communicate. It made things, I think it made our society safer. We have the greater ability to communicate. It may be annoying. Social media may be annoying, but there are so many great things that happen as a result of this technology. That's one thing. But then all of a sudden, there's all these little seedlings that pop up. Not every startup is going to take off. Not every tech company, not every monster tech company has something that they're going to follow through with. Amazon just hit the brakes on a number of projects. You know, they quite often will go down a road, they'll invest some money, and then they hit the brakes and go, well, that's not going to pan out because inevitably it's now at this point we know it's not going to go the way we thought it was going to go. But the problem is that the Silicon Valley thing, the tech thing, they were treated like SBF. You know, in the media, these are the tech people that, I'm all for them making a ton of money. But if they take that risk and they lose that money, even in something like this, I don't wish this on anybody. But I also don't take the responsibility for anybody else. And taxpayer money cannot be part of the equation here.
Well, if you do this in this particular situation, then don't you do it for every situation?
Well, exactly. That's why I said Bitcoin.
Every bank meltdown.
Yeah.
Is going to have repercussions that will be felt for a while. But isn't this the government setting the base now for irresponsible actions on banks? Maybe not related to this thing, but we can take the chance because, look, they're not going to let people suffer.
Right.
This isn't going to happen. You set up this mindset. The pathology of dependency.
No, that's exactly it.
Don't worry. We can do anything we want with the money because the government isn't going to dare let a bank fail. Interesting point, too. They're talking about the head of the one of the banking commissions that Biden put in on the federal level said there probably won't be a sale because of her. That they the regulation of selling a bank like this, where they can come in and make the situation much, much better. And I got to get into that because I don't know the specifics of it. I just saw that allegation yesterday. I forgot who made it. I've been reading so much. But it was really interesting saying, well, the appointing from Trump is just so tough on letting another bank come in and buy a bank that's...
Trump, you know, or Biden? You said Biden earlier.
Biden. Yeah, okay. Biden. I'm sorry. Did I say Trump?
Mm-hmm.
I meant Biden. There probably won't be a sale. And it doesn't look like now that they're guaranteeing everything tomorrow. I don't know. Maybe that's the start. Maybe that is at the... No, because you wouldn't want that. If you're trying to sell it, you're not going to bail them out because it's likely to be easier for another bank to pick them up at more of a bargain rate.
Yeah. I mean, that's Washington. Washington Mutual went to Chase, you know, and so you could look at it and say, okay, look, their assets go to this and put them on the auction block. And for those that, you know, that are right now wondering if they're going to get everything, you know, I mean, hope for the best. And if those assets are there, look, if it's true that their assets will cover 95% of the deposits, outstanding deposits, then consider yourself lucky.
Mm-hmm.
And also consider this a lesson learned.
Well, if it does cover 95%, well, then why do the bailout? It's imagery.
That's exactly.
It's imagery.
Right.
We need
and I don't know who you're appealing to, you know, with that kind of bailout, you know, who politically who you're trying to appeal to.
866-90-RED-EYE.
We'll be right back with more Red Eye Radio with Eric Harley and Gary McNamara.
It's Red Eye Radio. He's Eric Harley, and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90-RED-EYE. I mean, it's going to start later on today. I mean, the populist opinion, it's a very, very popular opinion. You're going to bail out. You know, remember back in 2008, 2009, we would get calls. Look, I'm a conservative Republican, but if the banks get bailed out, they need to bail me out.
Right.
No, they need to bail no one out.
Right.
but in this particular case, where these aren't even just, you know, so-called the generic banks, but these are basically the deposits of venture capitalists.
Yeah.
You know, that they have hundreds of millions of dollars that they put in. The FDIC was never, you know, it was never enacted to do that. It was for the little guy to protect the smaller deposits.
Right.
And the law doesn't even state that they can do this. Congress doesn't state that they can do this. And Yellen does it. There's going to be pushback to this, and it's going to be the perfect populist. You want a perfect populist argument?
Yeah,
you know, we're suffering. We're not getting bailout, and these rich venture capitalists.
Yeah, she wants to track every deposit of yours over $600.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. She also wants to bail out massive companies and millionaires and multimillionaires and multimillion dollar companies.
Top of the hour news is brought to you by Howes Products. Visit HowesProducts.com.
This is Red Eye Radio on Westwood One. Now, it's Red Eye Radio. Gary McNamara and Eric Harley talk about everything from politics to social issues and news of the day. Whether you're up late or you're just starting your day, welcome to the show. This is Red Eye Radio.
All across the USA and around the planet, 866-90-RED-EYE. He is Eric Harley and I'm Gary McNamara. Download our Red Eye Radio app today and listen when, where you want, if you can't listen live overnight. You say you got some correspondence that said this is not a bailout?
Well, I don't know what it's. Someone sent me tagged me in a tweet by Bill Ackman. Bill Ackman is with the CEO of Pershing Square Financial Company, And he posted something earlier, a few hours ago. And I don't know what if, because it's hard to know if he's responding to something. I don't see there's a thread of responses to this tweet. But I don't know if he was posting a series of tweets because I just haven't had time to read it. I'm just reading a lot of this for the first time.
But
he breaks down in the second paragraph, he basically breaks down what you and I lined out last hour. And he's lining out here that here, in this case, of what happened this weekend, the shareholders and bondholders have been wiped out. The FDIC insurance fund capitalized by premiums paid by banks will absorb any losses, and the fund will recoup any losses by assessing more premiums on the banks. Higher premiums on the banks are going to be passed on to the consumer, and we covered that last hour. So that part of it is if that's how that goes down, that it, because either way, it's going to be paid for by people, whether it's taxpayer dollars or not. But if they get into it, the question is, and I guess there's a million questions, but the first question here is, well, you talk about the investors. What about the depositors, and to what extent, and why would there not be a sale of the assets in this case? Because if you talk about, well, okay, then the premiums are going to take a hit, and then basically all the banks take a hit because they've got to pass that premium increase on to their consumers, their customers. Well, tell me why that should happen.
Well, I look at it that any type of government regulation that makes the cost of a service higher is passed on to the consumer. That's what we stated. That's what they're stating there. And so if the insurance goes up for FDIC, mm-hmm. it's passed on to the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. And so I we're still, I mean, it's not if you want to get into the minutiae of a direct bailout versus an indirect bailout, but we also said, and it was Phil Klein, National Review, who said they believe that 95% of the deposits can be paid off after the assets are sold. But that could be a while.
Yeah.
So you don't get your money then. But the other thing is the banks will probably sue the federal government because Congress didn't approve this.
Yeah.
Congress sets the $250,000. So the banks, if they're going to be charged higher fees to bail out this bank, will probably go to court if it's reversed and all these deposits are already paid out and the assets don't cover the deposits, it will be a direct bailout by the taxpayers.
Well, and that's where, you know, there's later in this another paragraph from this tweet from Bill Ackman. He writes, our government did the right thing. This was not a bailout in any form. The people who screwed up will bear the consequences. That isn't true.
No, that's not true.
The investors who didn't adequately oversee their banks will be zeroed out, and the bondholders will suffer a similar fate. Look, there's no doubt there's going to be a massive lesson here. And he points out, too, that there could be, you know, other bank failures. More banks will likely fail despite the intervention, but we now have a clear roadmap for how the government will manage them.
Well,
do we? I don't know that we do.
No, neither do I. And to say it's not a bailout, we never said it was a stockholder bailout. We knew the mm-hmm. stockholders are going to get wiped out. And again, I don't know. This thing just happened. I can't tell you precisely, right. You know, what happened. You can look at those that cover this every day. But when Yellen herself says, and that's what we're going on, that this will be covered by the FDIC, and those deposits over $250,000, and I saw one of the top deposits was like $400 million.
Mm-hmm.
That the FDIC will be charged for it, and if it causes a problem, all bank rates will be raised. Well, that's going to be passed down to the consumer.
Yeah.
That is an indirect bailout. There's no way you can. Now, again, if it's he's trying to change the definition of the word bailout, but it's a depositor bailout that does not exist in the law that will raise prices, and just like a corporate tax, will affect the consumer because it will be passed on one way or another.
Right. And you know, that's what it comes down to. It's, I don't know. I expect the CEO of a financial company to, you know, to stand up and say, well, this isn't a bailout. I don't know that just yet. First of all, it's very early. Just like you mentioned, I think that's the key here. We don't know if this is a taxpayer bailout, a taxpayer bailout just yet. We don't know.
Which is why we started the show asking in a question form.
And because it could come in a couple of different ways. I mean, passing, you know, if the premiums on the FDIC insurance go up, then, you know, that's not necessarily, I don't know. I guess we could get into the minutia of what defines a taxpayer bailout. But if you're talking about then manipulating the law and applying something where it doesn't belong, where those benefits don't belong, then that definitely is a taxpayer bailout. And then, you know, to what extent are we going to do this? Look, there were huge risks here by a number of individuals along the way. And all of those actors in those settings had information in front of them. Or were they looking through their SBF glasses? Oh, he's so cool. Oh, this is so cool. Ooh, our actual name is Silicon Valley Bank. I mean, my point is that you can see the real stuff, and then you can look at stuff and say, oh, well, man, that's trendy. Everybody's in on it. Well, does that mean it's real? When Signature had so much involvement in crypto, how in the world? I mean, I just look at these things, and I'm talking as a layman. I'm talking as somebody who is not an investment banker. I'm you know, not a financial expert, because all those people are trillionaires because they know everything and they're right on every prediction. All I'm saying is I look at something, and if it doesn't seem real, you're talking about, think about the scale we're talking about. Now, I don't know, the majority of people, probably it's safe to say, the majority of people before last week had never heard of Silicon Valley Bank. Silicon Valley, yes. They make a really good ranch dressing, by the way. It's very, very tasty. But
you just made me think of something, but go ahead.
But the thing is that these are not stupid individuals in this entire scenario. But how much risk were they willing to take? How much thin ice were they willing to skate on? And with Signature, their involvement in crypto. I'm just asking these questions. And so when they take that hit, and Ackman does point that out, that a lot of players here are going to, you know, they're going to be taking their own hits. Mm-hmm. And that's great. Let's not manipulate the law to cover them. Let's not do. And I can hear I can also hear the response on the, well, of course, the fees, you know, are going to go up in your bank. It's like when there's a storm and then all of a sudden everybody's paying higher homeowners insurance. Yeah, but we can mitigate that. There are things that I can do and that can mitigate that to a large extent. I'm not skating on the thin ice. I'm not playing the same risk that they're playing. And
so you mean someone's trying to make the comparison of a natural disaster to
I can already hear that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I can already hear that, saying
that it was an act of God.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you could say, all right, look, I don't have a house on the beach where hurricanes hit, right? I don't live there. Or I don't live in the heart of Tornado Alley. Actually, we do live in Tornado Alley. I'm just saying that you could say, all right, these are the things I want to mitigate. All right. I live in Arizona, so I invest a lot in air conditioning. You know, choices I can make as an individual where I'm not a player and shouldn't have to, you know, foot part of that bill. I know how things work when fees go up. But is that a result of manipulation of the law to benefit others who knowingly took great risk?
Now, you talked about all economists being rich.
Yeah.
I just wondered later on today on CNBC whether Jim Cramer will cry again. You heard last month he urged his viewers to buy Silicon Valley Bank stock. According to the New York Post here.
I don't know how he still has a job. I really don't. I don't get it at all. Is he on The View? Is he also on The View?
He's the View's new financial segment starring Jim Cramer.
And he'll cry every time.
Right. There are always lawyers and reputable economists there to fact check him every day.
Sell.
Okay. 866-90-RED-EYE.
Most owner-operators leased to larger carriers are paid on a per-mile basis or a percentage of revenue per load. The per-mile basis is most prevalent among larger fleets, percentage at smaller. Pay per mile tends to dominate discussions about pay just because it's easier to measure, and pay per mile often is wrongly used as the deciding factor in leasing to a carrier. While pay per mile can be a vital factor, it's not a cure for every ill. Nor does it mean a big settlement check is coming an owner-operator's way. Why? Because pay per mile always must be considered in balance with gross revenue as well as total costs. Gross revenue can include flat mileage pay that varies by length of haul, percentage revenue pay, and more. Most importantly, though, for every revenue dollar generated, only part of that dollar is profit. But for every extra dollar of cost saved, the entire dollar contributes to profit. Knowing and understanding your cost to operate is fundamental to understanding the true value of any pay package. Owner-Operator Business 101 is provided by Shell Rotella. Shell Rotella, with advanced synthetic technology, is designed to help keep your rig running with more mileage and less maintenance.
Coming up, more with Gary McNamara and Eric Harley. It's Red Eye Radio.
Hey, it's Red Eye Radio. He's Eric Harley, and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90-RED-EYE. I found the audio from Jim Cramer.
Okay.
You just, when you said economists are all trillionaires, I burst out laughing. and that made me think of that story out there that Jim Cramer was promoting SVP Bank as one of the best stocks to buy. Here we go.
They are the best value, especially if you like to imbibe. The ninth best performer year to date is SVB Financial, don't you want? This company's a merchant bank with a deposit base that Wall Street had been mistakenly concerned about. SVB is the old Silicon Valley Bank. Recently bought one of our favorite research firms, Buffett Nathanson, and it's become less dependent upon private equity and venture capitalist offerings. Wait a second. Those dried up last year, they could come back. Yes, some of them come back here with the stock directly affects an oversold position. Stock was the fourth worst performer in 2022. I think the fears were not justified, and it's a very compelling situation. Hey, by the way, long-term private equity and venture capital, they're not going away. Being the banker to these immense pools of capital has always been a very good business.
Oh, that aged well.
Is he going to cry today? Remember when he, what advice did he give out? It's within the last 6 months. I remember because we played him basically crying on the air because of his advice, and I forgot what stock it was.
I don't know, but I can't remember, but it was something of this nature. What was it? It was something, but and then it just became a big story. Oh, we'll have to go back and find it. But no, that's it. You know, he doesn't break it down as to why he thinks the whole thing, you know, and that what you just heard was overplayed. Why the bad news about Silicon Valley Financial was you know, it's
Meta stock. Last fall, Cramer appeared on CNBC's airwaves and offered an emotional apology to viewers touting Meta stock, the value of which plummeted by some 25% during a single trading session. Since the apology, however, Meta shares have rebounded, but still they have problems.
Well, and the company's basically abandoning their venture into animation.
You said,
look,
though,
you can be a cartoon.
You said, though, because you were reading that one. Some listener sent us a story.
And a tweet by Bill Ackman.
And Peter Schiff, the economist,
hit
back at him.
Oh, yeah. I found that just as we went into the break. And so here's the economist, Peter Schiff, responding to Bill Ackman. Bill Ackman, you know, saying, oh, this is not a bailout. And he says, and Peter Schiff responds, you couldn't be more wrong. By the way, I love tweets that sound that start that way. Government guaranteed bank accounts are a major part of the problem. We need capitalism in banking, not socialism. Having a sound banking system requires banks to compete for customers based on safety. The moral hazard of deposit insurance prevents it. Another person in the thread says, so curious how many people supporting this bailout are against student loan forgiveness. Would love to hear the difference. And Peter Schiff is not for either, but he did respond to that, and he starts with, I'm opposed to both. But I'm also opposed to government guaranteed or direct student loans. I'd be in favor of forgiving current student loans if we ban the government from ever making or guaranteeing another student loans again. Well, he kind of makes a point. I think he's making that tongue in cheek.
But that is a big but.
Yeah,
that's a huge but.
Well, it's a conditional statement, but it's one of those that you know isn't going to happen. Government loans are why college is so expensive, and he's absolutely right. And we hadn't mentioned Peter Schiff's name in a long time. And I'm going to hit that follow button right now. But he makes a good point here. And that's what it comes down to, is that we talked about this, and if you've listened to us for any amount of time, we went through and we were breaking down what happened in the mortgage meltdown. A lot of other people did that. David Faber did his special House of Cards, not to be confused with the Netflix thing. And on CNBC, didn't go back far enough as to where this all began.
Left out a huge part of the equation, is the government involved in the mortgage business.
You take Fannie and Freddie out of the equation, then what do you have? You have lenders and borrowers across the table from each other, and the lender qualifying in a way that should have been done all along. But when you have the U.S. government's going to back it, expect a bunch of guys to go out and bundle these things, and well, exactly what happened, and that's how we got there in short form.
Afford Anything talks about how to avoid common pitfalls, how to refine your mental models, and how to think about how to think.
Paula, while certainly you can mess up on $1 million a year, it is far less likely than it is on $30,000 a year.
Right.
I would meet wonderful people that were struggling with a budget that was super tight. It was 100%. You need to make more money.
Make smarter choices and build a better life.
Afford Anything, wherever you listen.
Giving you 70% each night, Eric Harley and Gary McNamara on Red Eye Radio.
That's okay on the show, but probably doesn't cut it in banking.
Yeah.
Eric
and Gary savings and loan will make sure that at least 70% of your money is still there in the morning.
Nobody gives you a toaster anymore when if you open up a bank account. Remember that? There's no incentives anymore, is there?
There's cash now, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Got to be quite a bit of money. I haven't seen that. Nobody's offering.
No, it's typically like $200 or $300 if you open a new bank account, and then you have to make
a new bank account.
Okay. A deposit. You know, yeah, that's what
okay.
it's.
All right.
You know, just like back in the day, it was getting a toaster for opening a new savings account. This mm-hmm. is a new checking account. You get $300. I would rather have the toaster. $300. That's useless. I can make toast with a toaster.
Let's go to Andy in Rockwall, Texas. Andy, welcome. You're on Red Eye Radio. Welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. First of all, the Kramer bit was hilarious. And I'm not as much a ranch dressing guy as I am a blue cheese dressing guy. But my question is, if we're going to manipulate laws to make whole people in these financial institutions, where am I not entitled to demand that the laws be manipulated to reimburse me for losses in my 401k accounts?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I think it's a great point. You know, I brought up crypto, Andy, as an example. Hey, if you lost money on Bitcoin, then the government should just step in and make you whole. We're just, of course, making the point. If we're going to do this, then go full on. But you make it, I think, even more fair comparison, because we're talking mm-hmm. about people's retirements, right? And of course, we've all been watching the ups and, well, hopefully you're not watching it on a day-to-day basis, but we watch the ups and downs over the years, and we see that, and it can hit really, really hard. My father will be 90 in May, and you know, he still, of course, draws from his 401k as mandated by law. But you know, when you're at a fixed income, you know, that you start taking a hit when the economy goes down, and everybody is, my gosh, where wouldn't you bail people out? If you're going to go this far with banks like this, then where wouldn't you step in, right?
But you make the point when you talk about, you know, talk about socialism and banking and finance and things like that. But when you talk about your 401k, if you have a 401k, and especially when it starts growing, you start looking at it. Uh-huh. There's a number of options you can be in. You look at the risk. Mm-hmm. You say, okay, I need to get out of these mutual funds and into these over here.
You can get in a stable fund.
Right, funds. Yeah. And so it makes you pay attention. You just don't sit there and say, well, whatever, no matter what happens, you know, if I've worked my entire life and I have $500,000, I don't have to worry about it, you know, just let it flow or whatever. No, you actually make plans and you pay attention. You pay attention.
That's a great point. It's actually a learning experience if you are paying attention. You do learn, because then it becomes your money. Great point, Andy. Thanks, Andy, for the call. We appreciate it.
I will say the other thing, too, that is being brought up, and we haven't touched on this yet. You know, and you and I always go back to the 2012 election when Romney, and there were other Republicans out there saying that the Chinese manipulate their currency.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you just heard it, and everybody got behind it.
Yeah.
And it was just, I mean, that was the narrative there.
Yeah.
It was like, you and I were sitting there one day on the air, we're waiting.
Right.
You know, these Chinese, how dare they manipulate we manipulate our currency.
Right.
We do it all the time. And it's just like, it's like that narrative was never out there, because no, it was a good attack on the Chinese, but you know, we have done it. And when you think about the manipulation of interest rates.
Right.
That has been done for over a decade in order to make it so government could borrow trillions of dollars and pay a very small interest rate on it. But then it gets to the point where that comes back and haunts you, because then you don't have people wanting to buy your treasury bills anymore.
Right.
Unless you keep it in a very dire situation where it's like, okay, I'm not going to make any interest, you know, on these bonds or treasury bills or whatever. But it's safe. It's safe. At least I'll get back what I put in. But it's talked about how, you know, SVP, because you think about it, they couldn't make anything by putting it into treasuries.
Right.
Where you know, if you let the market more control, you know, what is paid. But the manipulation over 2008 made it so, okay, we need to put it in something else that's going to make it long term,
mm-hmm.
where we have to take a risk at this point. But we need to do that because we've got these depositors and we've got to put it somewhere, and we're not going to put it in treasury bills.
Right, right.
And so we're going to put these deposits in these particular financial instruments, and it comes back to haunt you, and it's like, okay, well, we need to bail that out too. When the government is just manipulating across the board everything.
Yeah.
And I get so sick and tired of, well, the Fed's job is to make sure that interest rates stay below, or that the prime interest rate stays below 2%, and at the same time ensure that unemployment. Stop it!
Well, you know, I mean, that's the whole thing, is that Peter Schiff points out, and I think, you know, and not as a direct way, but I think you and I have pointed out over the years that, you know, having a sound banking system requires, and this is directly from his tweet, his response, Peter Schiff's response on Twitter to Bill Ackman, having a sound banking system requires banks to compete for customers based on safety, sure footing. And you and I have talked about that. We talked about it for many years on the whole housing collapse. And when they created the subprime mess, you go back to the article, September 30th, 1999, in the New York Times, they wrote about it and warned about it, that this will dwarf the savings and loan fallout if they go through with this subprime thing. And basically it comes down to, when you create that kind of backing, socialism in that kind of financial setting, and think about it, because for most people, it is the greatest investment you will make if you buy a home. You back it. If the U.S. government, Fannie and Freddie, are in it, well, there's no way it can fail. So everybody's going to take risks they wouldn't take. And the banks did just that, putting money in hands of people that shouldn't have had maybe that much money. Maybe some of them shouldn't have had any money to buy a home at that point. But they had assets, they had loans like the NINA, which stood for No Income, No Assets. What is that? Prove you're breathing and we'll give you a loan. It was stupid. They were putting so much money on the streets. People went shopping, and the price of houses just went way through the roof. And those people shouldn't have had that much money. Some of them shouldn't have had any money. And then, of course, the whole zero down. No teeth in the game. And people were wondering why they were abandoning properties and didn't really care. In fact, some of the appliances were either damaged or taken from the properties in some cases, because people didn't have any teeth in the game. When you put 50 grand down or 30 grand down or whatever it's going to be, that's your money you don't want to walk away from. These are the very principles of borrowing and lending that should be in play, where the government doesn't come in and say, well, we'll back it. And so when they started bundling these things and these assets, these bundled assets, got these massive ratings, the highest of all ratings. Oh, but no, they all had AAA ratings. Because the U.S. government, if the U.S. government is backing it, who wouldn't buy them?
Because remember, there's going to be investigations and nothing happened there.
Nothing happened.
Investigated. Why were these AAA rated? They were AAA rated because there was the implied guarantee of the United States of America.
Exactly.
You financial idiots.
Right.
We need to get to the bottom of it. It's not hard to get to the bottom of it.
In 2003, I think it was actually on September 11, 2003, then Treasury Secretary Snow was testifying, and he was saying to Barney Frank, Fannie and Freddie cannot sustain this. And Barney Frank turns around along with other Democrats and said, no, the problem is, we're not doing enough of this. What they wanted you to believe is that, well, there's some bad paper out there. Create more good paper, and it will make the bad, it will dilute the bad paper in that equation. That's like saying you have a tiny hole in your tire, but it's fine.
You know how you create good paper? You create good paper by not having the government involved in the mortgage business.
Exactly.
And so people are buying smaller homes that are more affordable,
yeah,
that they can actually get into. And so, you know, and that's how the system would be much more stable over the long term. Now, you may not have those incredible years that were built on a false foundation.
Exactly.
I like
right.
that.
Yeah. No, that's a good one. Yeah.
Built on a false foundation.
Right.
But you would have people probably in smaller, newer homes that they were able to afford, and at the same time building their credit, building their actual worth, because you know what is a house worth if the person in it cannot afford it?
Exactly.
What is a house actually worth at that particular point? Because we saw the crash,
right?
We saw what happened in the crash, how the values, you know, went down, you know, severely in the housing market,
and how many can't pay for it,
and how many people, how many tens of millions of people were destroyed forever that probably couldn't get a mortgage for another 20 years.
And that was the thing. The government was coming in saying, well, these individuals should have the American dream of home ownership, and we should get them out of poor neighborhoods or apartments. And this is the idea that, and this liberal idea, which is often built on this noble sounding idea, will give them the American dream. Well, but in turn, what you did was, because when you look at the credit agencies and underwriters, going forward, when they see somebody that has a foreclosure, they look at that in a serious way, because what they're saying is they couldn't sustain putting a roof over their family's head. Even bankruptcy is going to the courts and saying, I'm here to deal with the fact that I can't pay. Foreclosure is looked at differently. I have people close to me that are underwriters and have been for years of major financial companies, and that's just the way they look at it. So instead of this noble idea of American dream, now you've got foreclosures on their books, and they may never qualify for a home because you wanted to force it as a government. That, to me, should be looked into, but it never will be. And you and I have been talking about this for a long, long time. Everything we're talking about here happened because the government stepped in and wanted to force something that wasn't real.
866-90-RED-EYE.
Lines open for your calls. 866-90-RED-EYE on Red Eye Radio.
It's Red Eye Radio. He's Eric Cronin. I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90 Red Eye. And the Signature Bank that went under, I didn't know until you told me Barney Frank is on the board of directors.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
How in the living
I'm gonna
curse here, and I don't want to curse. How in the world, after the debacle that he was about and what he promoted in the mortgage meltdown in 2008-2009, how could anyone in the private sector put him on any type of board that has to do with anything financial in the United States of America, ever?
Remember right at the end of his time in Congress, when the day he went on CNBC and claimed, because I just mentioned when then Treasury Secretary Snow in 2003 was testifying, and he was promoting, they were all promoting, you know, no, home ownership. And he went on CNBC. I think he may have been out of office, maybe a short time at that point. And he says, oh, well, I never, years later after 2003, I never promoted home ownership. I always said that apartment living would be better.
Absolute liar.
The phones melted down. There was a story that day of how the people just bombarded CNBC's phones when he said that. That's how bad that whole situation with the mortgage meltdown was. And he's on the board at Signature. No, thank you. I'll take my money somewhere else, please.
So you'd like to be a fireman? Yes.
Yeah.
And what are your qualifications? I'm an arsonist for the mob.
Yeah.
In order to collect insurance payments.
Yeah. I have lots of matches. I'm a great match for this company. See what I did? See what I did there?
You know, that really wasn't funny, but I imagine Barney Frank saying it, and that's why I laughed.
It was only funny because it was so stupid.
Stupid, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's, you know, and that's the whole thing is that most people, you don't have to be, you don't have to do that for a living in order to see what is what, you know, and that's the whole idea is that any layman can look at this and say, wow, yeah, this was bound to go bad when you know the facts.
This is Red Eye Radio on Westwood One. Now, it's Red Eye Radio. Gary McNamara and Eric Harley talk about everything from politics to social issues and news of the day. Whether you're up late or you're just starting your day, welcome to the show. This is Red Eye Radio.
All across the USA and around the world, we are Red Eye Radio. He is Eric Harley, and I'm Gary McNamara. If you can't listen live overnight, you can download our app and listen when and where you want.
And it's okay. Sometimes we're not talking live. Like right now, Gary's live, and I'm recorded.
Yes. I am live. Eric is AI.
Well, I'm just A. That second part is questionable, frankly.
You are an A. You know what I miss? You know what I really miss this time of the year?
Liquor? Oh, what?
Well, no, because Friday is St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, okay.
Look, do you see? I
oh, wore, it is,
look,
isn't it?
Look, see what I have on?
Oh.
I'm wearing a
it says Shamrocks and Shenanigans.
Yes.
Oh, you're going for both. Shamrocks and
shenanigans. Yes, I started wearing the Irish stuff early this year. let me see. Did I drink last St. Patrick's Day? No. The one before? No. The one before? No. So probably no for this Friday.
Yeah, it's probably been over 30 years since I've actually had a drink on St. Patrick's Day.
Thing for me though, Saint, you know, St. Patrick's Day for me,
yeah,
is always memorable.
Yeah,
that's when if I hadn't made an oral agreement that day, I wouldn't be here.
Oh,
23 years ago.
Oh,
23 years ago is when I guess it was an interview because I got a job out of it and I agreed to do it. Oh. Did I ever tell you that story? Because I was thinking of getting out of talk radio but. You know, Bob called me.
Right.
You know, and he just said, I don't know. He said, why don't you come in and sit in? They actually paid me. I came in and sat in a show for 2 days, and it was the 16th and 17th of March in 2000. Huh. And it happened to be a Friday or Thursday and a Friday, same thing.
Wow.
And they paid me, and I was like, well, we'll pay you to come in. We'll pay you to fill in for the show. And I'm like, well, okay, and see how you like it. And it was really cool. It wasn't like, wow, you have an interview here.
Yeah.
And I knew it was. I mean, but it was like it wasn't presented. So I filled in on that Thursday. I can remember one of the topics that I brought up.
Yeah.
Gasoline had gone over $1.60 a gallon.
Yeah, yeah.
That was the topic. I'll never forget that.
Yep. That was the big deal.
and again, so you come in, you're just filling in. And, you know, I flew in to Dallas and then came in and did, and it was like, oh, this is easy. Because, you know, it's like gas prices, of course, the phone's going to go crazy.
Right. Yeah, I remember back then, because I was doing the this show, the all-night show, and truck drivers were
gosh,
they were hurting so bad because fuel surcharges were basically non-existent. Mm-hmm. And they were having to park their truck because of the massive increase in diesel costs.
And so it came, the show was, I filled in 9 to 11.
Mm.
So 11's over, and I went in, and Bob said, let's go to lunch.
Yeah.
So we go to this, and it was the second day, like this will be, of, you know, the March Madness.
Oh, yeah.
And so we went to, like, this sports bar, and it's, you know, all over the place.
Right,
like
yeah.
And Bob looks at me, and I had a history with Bob. I mean, I knew Bob well before, but he had tried to hire me in previously in Madison, Wisconsin, and then in Albuquerque.
Yeah.
And both times I turned him down.
Yeah.
So I'll never forget.
I've let Bob down, too, several times.
I don't know if Bob would.
Oh, you said turned him down.
Yeah, okay, turned him down. Yeah. I don't know if Bob would remember this, but he actually said, what do you think? And I said, yeah, I think I fit. He goes, so do I, because I think you fit really well.
Yeah.
He said, but I'm not going to offer you the job because you've turned me down twice. and I'm not going to make it a third time.
Right.
I had the best interviews.
Yeah.
That interview was better than when I interviewed in Nashville one time.
Yeah.
And I flew in on a Friday night, woke up early, toured all the facilities. We talked a little bit, didn't get to the money part of it, then went to the program director's house, watched football because it was like 3 days before Christmas.
Yeah.
Watched football and he goes, have a beer. And
I'm
like, why am I? Wow. I have the weirdest interviews. When a Portland, Oregon interview, come on, let's take a ride on my boat. Right? Would you like a beer? I'm like, oh, man, it goes against everything. Having alcohol on an interview, are you nuts? You can't do it. But in the situations I was in, I'm like, okay, I'll have a beer.
Yeah, right.
And I still got both jobs. Still was offered both jobs.
Right, yeah.
Well, accepted one, turned down the other. He said, I'm not going to offer it to you. He said, you have to tell me whether you'd be interested. And I said, yeah, I am. And if you want to hire me, if I want to work here, if you want to hire me, I think I put it like that.
Yeah.
I said, I want to work here if you want to hire me. He says, okay. And then it went on from there, but it was just,
yeah, wow.
And I can still remember because it was St. Patrick's Day. And I remember I had nothing to do on that because it was like Friday at noon. And then I was back at the hotel probably by 1 or 2 in the afternoon.
Yeah.
There's nothing to do. And then, what the heck? It's like got to be happy hour. Mm. And I was in the apartments right across the street from our old studio. Remember the hotel? Right there?
Yeah.
So the hotel bar was there. I'll never forget going over there like around happy hour time, getting something to eat. And there were just people were just drunk as you could imagine.
I've heard the stories. Yeah.
It was really...
I had a similar meeting with Bob early on when he started. He started a few years after I did, and you know, it was like we had this great meeting. And I said, you know what? Let's have some drinks. And he said, we're at IHOP, and it's 7 a.m. I said, so? You know what's weird, though? It just occurred to me. I also came to this town. Sudden, I'm in a Western. I also came to this market in March. It was March of 95. It wasn't this company, but I worked for a station called The Edge. It's not around anymore, but I was hired to The Edge in March of 95. I had one day off between jobs. I left a small town, had one day off. My niece was born on that day. And then the next day I started my job here in Dallas. And so I never put that together. I know you, I'm sure you'd told the story before about when you came to WBAP.
Mm-hmm.
I know I've heard it. And I don't know why I never put that together, but I also started in this town in March.
Well, it's really interesting because March, for some reason, I started my first radio job out of college in March.
Yeah.
And then I got out for a few years and, you know, worked at the steel plant, machinist, things like that.
Yeah.
And I got back in March of 83.
Right.
So actually this is for the second time I got back in radio was March of 83, which would have been last week. Like a week ago Monday a week ago Monday is when I would have started in Florida.
Right.
At a rock station. And so that was 40 years ago. And I was thinking about that last week because it's like,
yeah.
If you take the 9 months that I was in previous to that, by the time we get to this summer, it'll be 41 years.
Mm.
I'm like, my God, how the... Because it doesn't... I look at everybody else that I know in radio, everybody else that I know, including people that I didn't know but respected.
Mm-hmm.
And many of those were in music radio, and they were all done by the time they were in their
40s. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm still in here.
How they moved on to other careers.
And I don't feel like... And it's based on just, and I've only had these thoughts really the last few years as you know, when I got close to retirement age and
right.
made the decision, no, that's not going to happen.
Right.
And I just, it's like how blessed I am, how incredibly blessed I am, because the only reason I'm here is because of stubbornness and stupidity. I was never, I had no natural talent at all. The only thing I think I had in talent was I was stubborn. I was stubborn and I was too stupid to know how hard it was going to be because I loved it so much.
Oh, if you had told me back then, it's a different kind of work. I don't want to pretend.
It's work.
Because I have lifelong friends who do manual labor for a living and man, I don't think I could ever. I did just light lawn work over the weekend, just for a few minutes, and I'm sore. But there's so much that goes into it. I mean, it has to, especially working these hours. It requires a lot because the news cycle is not short. It's not, you know, just a few hours a day. It keeps going. But yeah, that's the same. I just kept showing up. I mean, I just didn't leave.
No, I'm like you. I probably could not work a laborer's job just because of the arthritis in my ankle and my back. You know, I couldn't be standing and lifting things and doing that at this. Not that I couldn't do it, but I'd have to sit.
Good for a project, I don't know that I could do that.
I'd have to sit down. Now, this is, though, when I look back at it, because I don't look at how I view being in radio now.
Mm-hmm.
It's how I was, especially talk radio,
mm-hmm.
when I started.
Mm-hmm.
And what a daunting task.
It's like a different career, isn't it?
It's a totally different career than music radio.
When you come out of music radio, and because there is, there was this the series of seminars that they sent us to, and when, back then I was like, I don't need seminars. I know everything there is to know about radio. I'm an expert. But no, I mean, you know, who wants to sit through a seminar? But I remember so much from that. And the Dan O'Day seminars, if anybody in radio is listening. And it was so great. And Dan was just so spot on. And it stayed with me when he was talking about, and he would play air checks of other radio personalities. Okay, this is what you got to do. You got to kind of share a little bit of yourself. And that's basically how you develop personality. But that was all about music radio. But then when you parlay that into and apply it to talk radio, especially the type of talk radio we do, you know, opinionated talk radio, you've got to share pretty much everything. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying everything, every day-to-day detail of your life, but you have to share who you are and how you believe. And a lot of people don't like that and probably wouldn't do that. And you and I know a number of people in broadcasting that just simply won't do that. And, you know, that it's just they wouldn't want to be in opinionated radio. Mm-hmm. For that reason.
Well, I'm not saying music radio was extremely hard because I went in thinking, I'll never forget, and it was my second stint, which would have started 40 years ago last week, and in a place like Fort Walton Beach, Navarre, Pensacola, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking to myself, going to the rock station there, I remember thinking, wow, parties, beach, bikinis, I mean, the things you're thinking of at that time.
You wore a bikini almost every day.
Right. I mean, and that was very there. Yeah. Well, I was ahead of my time. You know? I mean, I was ahead of my time in that one.
Yeah.
Trendsetter. Now it's like everybody doing it bad. That's where I did come up with the philosophy when everybody was talking, because I lived on the beach.
Right.
I lived on the beach. And that's where I came up with the philosophy where people were talking about, well, we need to have topless beaches. And I went, no, men need to put their tops back on. But it was hard. But it's almost like a different business because the mindset's completely different. Music radio was hard. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't prepared for it when I first went in. I wasn't. Mm-hmm. And when I first got hired, the first job I had in 78 for like 9 months, years later, you know, I connected with the owner again. And he said, what did you think? He said, you stayed in radio after you got out. He said, but you didn't get back in for a while. And I said, because I wasn't prepared.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't prepared to even do music radio.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was going to be easier. But the fact is, once you do anything for as long as we've done it,
mm-hmm.
and for myself, it's still work every day. But I would say the toughest part is not organizing your mind on the topics and analysis and study that you're doing, because that's natural. There is like a natural excitement to it. And I don't even recognize the hardest part of it anymore because I've done it for such a long time. When Independent Bob came up to me one time and said, you're the most disciplined person I've ever met in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, who the hell are you talking to? He goes, mm-hmm. your sleep shift, everything. And I didn't even realize it
mm-hmm.
because you're just doing it for the show. And I went, oh, yeah, you're right. I never thought about that. I do have to be disciplined every single day. I mean, almost down to the minute.
Yeah.
It's like, got to do this. And by this time, I've got to be here and do this and then go to sleep.
I have to get my 8 hours in every week.
Every week. Not every day for you, every week. Yeah.
No, I mean, there are things that absolutely do have to be put on the back burner,
right.
You know.
Yeah,
and those sacrifices you have to make because of just that it has to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the sacrifice is sleep, but really most everything has to wait because the show takes precedent.
So this all started because I mentioned the brackets, because mm-hmm. the brackets are out, and I thought, don't you miss the days, the good old days? This is how I started this off. We got into other tangents, but it was good tangents.
Uh-huh.
Oh, the good old days when the media was totally excited because Obama's going to let you know what his brackets are later on today.
Yeah. I think we're going to learn Biden's brackets. Oh, I'm sorry. No, that's racket.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah.
For ad lib, that was you got to be able to ad lib in talk radio.
Uh-huh.
That wasn't like a line you got. Remember the show prep books? Remember the little book? I remember I got the book that had like one liners that you would.
They had in the show prep services and everything.
Show prep services. Yeah.
That
almost sounded like that came from a show prep service. Not a bracket, but a racket.
That's not a bracket. That's a racket.
866-90-RED-EYE.
Get in touch with Red Eye Radio, toll free at 866-90-RED-EYE.
It's Red Eye Radio. He is Eric Carley, and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90 Red Eye. If you'd like to get into the show, I think that's what you're going to get, though, today. I think you're going to see the populist reaction, to the Silicon Valley Bank and then Signature Bank being bailed out. I think you're going to see a big pushback against the bailout. Above $250,000. And that's why they immediately came out and Janet Yellen said it's not a bailout. And that's why you get a lot of people that may be hurt by this saying it's not a bailout. It's not a bailout. It's not a bailout. Well, there's a question whether it will eventually be a bailout because we don't know how much the assets of the bank when finally sold off would be able to reimburse the depositors on this.
Right.
But if it's 95 or 90%, well, then it's still a bailout, as Janet Yellen said, indirectly, because they would raise the fees on the FDIC fees, which means that would be passed on to the consumer, which means you're paying it off. And the bad thing is the precedent it sets that doesn't really matter what you do. We have to bail out any bank, any major bank that goes under.
Well, it sounds like, it really is reminiscent of Fauci saying, well, that's not the definition of gain of function. Well, this isn't the definition of a bailout. Well, if other people are having to pay for it, yeah, it is.
Of course it is.
And so, this is where there's no credibility whatsoever with her and gosh, is it everybody in any position of power on the left? I mean, Fauci. Well, that's not gain of function. Well, this isn't a bailout.
Oh, yeah. Of course it is. Change of definition.
Right.
oh, we got to talk about Fauci.
No reasonable prosecutor. I mean, honestly, they all do it.
No.
And over again, everybody's like, well, I guess so. It's not a bailout. Janet Yellen says it's not a bailout. Yeah. Well, let's break it all down. Well, let's have transparency. Or is this all going to be classified by the end of the day?
Well, maybe what we're getting is transitory transparency.
Ah, yes.
Couldn't even say that.
The fourth branch of government, Eric Harley and Gary McNamara on Red Eye Radio.
It's Red Eye Radio. He's Eric Harley and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90 of Red Eye. You know, he hadn't written anything on this until, I believe, over the weekend. It would have been Saturday he wrote this, but I was wondering what constitutional law professor Jonathan Turley would think about what happened last week when Matt Taibbi and Michael Schellenberger were in front of the House and the way that they were treated by Democrats. Now, we played a number of things, but it was so long. I mean, it was a long thing. It was impossible to play it all last week on the show, so we tried to play the highlights. But he talks about Joseph Welch in the McCarthy hearings, that when Joseph Welch said, "At long last, have you left no sense of decency? Those words by the lawyer Joseph Welch during the famous McCarthy hearings. This week, nearly 70 years later, Welch's words seem more relevant than ever after House Democrats savaged two journalists who attempted to explain a government effort to censor citizens. It was only the latest in a series of hearings in which FBI agents and other whistleblowers, experts, and journalists have been personally attacked for raising free speech concerns. This week's hearings, talking about last week's hearings, showed definitively that we still live in a post-decency era. The latest attacks came after journalist Matt Taibbi and Michael Schellenberger testified about breaking the Twitter file story detailing how the FBI and other agencies secretly sought to censor or ban citizens from social media. Now, understand this again. Matt Taibbi and Michael Schellenberger, and they were asked the direct questions from Jim Jordan. Are you a Republican? No. Are you a MAGA Trump supporter? No. Who did you vote for in the last election? Biden. What are you? Democrats. It didn't matter. This all started, you go all the way back to Bernard Goldberg,
yep,
when he wrote his book Bias.
Yep.
And a few years later, these right-wing authors, he wasn't right-wing. He's a liberal.
Yeah.
He's a liberal who believed still in journalism. And that's what Matt Taibbi and Michael Schellenberger are. Well, you had Delegate Stacey Plaskett from the Virgin Islands, the ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee, attack them. By the way, she's horrible. She is just horrible. Jordan had her a couple times. You could see it in her face. She was almost sweating. It was almost, you could see on her face the tension, because they really don't have a point. But she attacked them as so-called journalists and said that Matt Taibbi and Michael Schellenberger were a direct threat to the safety of others by reporting the censorship story.
Hmm.
Taibbi pushed back, saying, "I'm not a so-called journalist," and giving a brief discussion or description of his award-winning career at Rolling Stone and other publications. Yet other committee members also attacked the honesty of the two journalists after failed efforts to claim that they were Elon Musk's corrupt scribes. They limited limited by him in their investigations. The committee members attacked their ethics. The witnesses were attacked on everything but their choice of socks. Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz even claimed that being a Republican witness today certainly casts a cloud over your objectivity. When Wasserman impugned the two journalists' honesty and ethics, she immediately reclaimed her time to prevent them from defending themselves. When the subcommittee chair gave them a chance to answer her claims, Wasserman Schultz and her Democratic colleagues objected that a witness was allowed to defend himself after being blocked from doing so. In an earlier attack, and I believe we played this last week, Representative Stephen Lynch prevented Taibbi from answering a question and dismissed his effort to defend his position, saying, "This is how it works. I'll ask a question, and you try to provide an answer if you can." And then wouldn't let him provide an answer.
Yeah.
Said, no, I'm not going to let you talk.
Yeah.
And then actually said that he wouldn't, after he wouldn't let him talk. I mean, it was horrible.
Yeah. No, it was bad.
After attacking the very notion of investigating the government for possible censorship efforts, the attacks then took a particularly menacing turn as some members began to demand confidential information. We played this part last week on journalist sources. Taibbi pushed back and said he could not reveal information on his sources, but that just seemed to make Democrats more irate. Representative Sylvia Garcia pressed Taibbi to say that Musk was a source. He replied again, "I can't give it to you, unfortunately, because this is a question of sourcing. I'm a journalist. I don't reveal my sources." And that's when it got ugly, and we played all this last week. Garcia effectively declared that she had trapped Taibbi because the only logical conclusion was that Musk was his source. When House Judiciary Committee Chairman Representative Jim Jordan objected to badgering a reporter for his sources, Democrats piled on. Plaskett declared that if Taibbi wouldn't comment on Musk, it must mean the Twitter owner was the source in question. It was a chilly but defining moment. For several years now, many Democratic members have embraced censorship on social media and resisted efforts to uncover government efforts to silence citizens. Now, I'm reading this here from Jonathan Turley. As someone who grew up in a liberal Democratic family in Chicago, I knew that a commitment to free speech was one of the most compelling values of the party back then. Today, free speech by the Democrats is treated as harmful and dangerous. President Joe Biden is arguably the most anti-free speech president since John Adams, and the Democratic Party is largely committed to censorship and speech regulations. Some Democratic figures, including Plaskett, have declared that hate speech is unprotected under the First Amendment, a categorically untrue claim. As the evidence mounts of an even broader censorship effort by the Biden administration, the Democrats' attacks have become more unhinged and unscrupulous. After shredding any fealty to free speech, they are now attacking journalists, demanding their sources, and claiming that their reporting is a public threat. Plaskett even attempted to defend the Federal Trade Commission, demanding that Twitter turn over the names of journalists who have communicated with the social media company. Other Democrats have shrugged off this outrageous demand by the FTC, headed by Chairwoman Lina Khan, a former Democratic staffer with the Judiciary Committee. For many of us, this week demonstrates the final severing of many House Democrats from both free speech and free press values. What is left now is raw rage and politics. There is a major difference between today and the McCarthyism of 1954. Back then, when Attorney Welch objected to the Republican senator trashing his client, the press lionized Welch. Yet, as noted by Schellenberger and Taibbi, today's media have remained largely silent as fellow reporters were attacked for covering the Twitter censorship story. If Joseph Walsh appeared today to support free speech, he might very well be dismissed as some QAnon conspiracy theorist or Putin lover. But his words from the past, that until this moment I think I have never really gauged your cruelty or your recklessness, should be read to every one of these members. It is not what we expect from our leaders today, but decency itself now seems to be irrelevant as reason. Yeah, I mean, it was bad last week. If you ever wanted to, you know, watching it as I did and playing some of the audio cuts, it really, you did recognize that the fascist mindset to defeat free speech and have the government be the regulatory organization for what is acceptable free speech, that fascist mindset is embedded as a mainstay. It's, you know, this isn't fringe anymore. It's
right.
not fringe in the Democratic Party. It is mainstream in the Democratic Party, just like identity politics and the race baiting and lying to cause. And that's the funny thing. You cannot find a bigger organization today that lies about almost everything than the Democratic Party, yet they are the ones that, by, if you look at it, by Jonathan Turley.
Yeah.
He would admit to that.
Yeah.
Jonathan Turley is a Democrat. He grew up as a liberal Democrat. He is the one, you know, you and you look at it, and so is Taibbi, so is Schellenberger. They're liberals who believe in free speech, and the Democratic Party does not. They believe that the government should regulate your speech and destroy you if you attempt to take advantage of your free speech rights.
Well, and that's it. And any question along the way is considered dissent, and any dissent is considered misinformation, disinformation, harmful, and then to the extent of it should be punished and you should be done away with. Your livelihood should be taken from you. Right. I mean, you can apply it in any way that you want to. If you're on the left, it should be shut down in California. If you know, at one point, if you use the wrong pronoun, then you faced jail time. Of course, that was overturned, but it was actually part of the law for a while in California. These are the things that, and then journalism, of course, how dare you? And this is where I think so much of this is, and the fallout from the Twitter files, part of the fallout is that we have said for a long time, you know, going back to Obama, they thought, Democrats thought they had won the White House forever. And then with social media, they thought they had won and were able to control the conversation forever. And then the liberal media, if you apply that outside of social media, they thought, okay, we control the narrative. Through the major media, the liberal media, we control the narrative. And here you have Michael Schellenberger and Matt Taibbi and Barry Weiss and others, again, not conservatives. They just want to do journalism. How dare you? No, we had already set it up where our narrative was going to be everything in the media. And if you ask a question, we'll label you and we'll tear you down. And that's where we are. And tell me your source. Who was your source? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I mean, it was really amazing to see last week. I mean, it was fascinating in how despicable it was.
Well, and the fact that they really did not hold back at all. They're proud of that. We'll come after you. You tell us your source. Freedom of the press is out the window.
Right.
I don't care that you're liberal. I want journalism. I think journalism plays a critical role in a free society. Real journalism. And I don't care who delivers it. I don't care what you believe in your mindset. Now, if you want to go off and have an opinion, write an opinion piece or do an opinionated show or whatever it is, great. But journalism, real journalism, plays a critical role in a free society. Well, the liberals can't have that.
And they took it a step further when they accused Taibbi and Schellenberger of, you know, of basically doing their job as journalists to find out what was going on at Twitter,
right,
and saying what they were doing was a threat to others and the country.
Right.
That's when you know it's bad.
Exactly.
When the politicians, when the leaders of this country start saying that doing a legitimate story is a threat to the country and a threat to others, that you shouldn't report a story.
Right. Right.
That's amazing. I mean, that's where the Democratic Party is today.
Yep.
866-90-RED-EYE.
We'll be right back with more Red Eye Radio with Eric Harley and Gary McNamara.
It's Red Eye Radio. He is Eric Harley, and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90 Red Eye. Fauci speaks, Republicans strike back. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
You know, and you saw that the House and the Senate both unanimously passed that the anything that's classified from COVID-19 ought to be declassified.
Yeah.
And the president, even after the House passed unanimous, as the Senate did, still won't say whether he'll veto it or not. Now, it doesn't matter because if it's been unanimous, they have the votes to override it.
Yeah.
But the fact that the White House couldn't immediately say, no, no, he's going to support it. Wow. And it's really interesting because you had Mike Turner on Meet the Press say, you know, Fauci's saying things that the intelligence doesn't back up.
Right.
That's why we need it out there. Right. Everybody wants it out there.
Right.
Let's release it because when it gets out there, you'll see Fauci is not being straight with you.
Right.
We'll get to the actual transcript of what he said coming up here, but that's just fascinating. Plus, in an MSNBC article, they went after Top Gun Maverick as insidious military propaganda, hoping before the Oscars that it wouldn't win anything big.
Oh, okay.
And it didn't. It won for sound.
This is Red Eye Radio on Westwood One. Now, it's Red Eye Radio. Gary McNamara and Eric Harley talk about everything from politics to social issues and news of the day. Whether you're up late or you're just starting your day, welcome to the show. This is Red Eye Radio.
All across the USA and around the world, 866-90-RED-EYE. He is Eric Harley, and I'm Gary McNamara. Download our Red Eye Radio app today, and you can listen when and where you want if you can't listen live overnight. Some breaking banking news out there from the other side of the world.
We'll see if this actually could play into some breaking news, possible breaking news later today. So this from ABC News just a few minutes ago. Silicon Valley Bank UK will be acquired by HSBC in a deal that will protect deposits in the UK's in the UK. And so now the question is, could there be a deal? I believed that throughout this weekend, you're likely going to have a lot of suitors at the table, just like you did with other, you know, with WaMu, the Washington Mutual fallout. Chase was, you know, took their assets. And so could it be that, and we don't know, but could it be that HSBC is also interested in taking the assets here in the States? But this, again, is Silicon Valley Bank UK will be acquired by HSBC in a deal that will protect deposits there. And so deposits will not be, according to the Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, deposits will be protected with no taxpayer support. And so we'll see where that goes stateside, if there's a deal to be done there. But I would guess that there would be, whether it's HSBC or another institution, they're probably going to step up. You're going to see maybe a few right now stepping up and telling regulators, hey, you don't have to do anything. If we can come in and make everything whole, we'll take it from here. There are plenty of big players capable of doing that. And we'll see if that happens here in the States with Silicon Valley
Bank. You saw Elon Musk say, I might buy it.
Well, did you know at the value at one point of SVB was $209 billion?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, at one point, Elon had close to that, somewhere in that area. You know, and it's funny because he probably would be a suitor. Now, of course, he would have to have partners and other assets lined up. But the first thing I thought of, that's funny because I didn't know that he had said or tweeted that he might buy it, you know. But at one point, his net worth was somewhere in that area of that bank's range of value. And we'll see where it goes from here. According to Barney Frank, Signature Bank was the bank that also was seized by federal regulators on Sunday, okay?
Right.
Now, their exposure in crypto was pretty huge.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, as of early 2022, roughly 27% of their deposits were from crypto companies, which that had doubled in about a 2-year period. So that's pretty big exposure. We all know what's happened to the crypto market since early last year. And you look at that kind of fallout. Now, Barney Frank, who was on the board, for former lawmaker, he's the Frank and Dodd-Frank, he said in a couple of different interviews that their bank, Signature Bank, was fine. It was okay, but it was fear driven by what happened with Silicon Valley Bank, and that's what drove the – he said actually it happened in a couple of hours. There was a run on their bank to the tune of billions of dollars. I don't have an exact figure in front of me, and I don't think he was precise on that number, but he said it happened within a couple of hours late Friday, and so regulators moved in on Sunday. So now you have two banks that are basically have fallen in a period of just a couple of days. Now, we'll see where it goes. If there is another bank that's willing to step in and make the depositors whole and like they've done with Silicon Valley Bank UK. Again, that's breaking news coming across in the last few minutes that HSBC will be acquiring Silicon Valley Bank UK. And it is, about when those other banks move in, the bigger banks move in to get, take over those assets. They have to work through regulators, of course, in those countries, and that's going to be a bit of a chess game here over the next couple of days. But it wouldn't surprise me if we were to hear later today or maybe tomorrow that a large bank has taken over Silicon Valley Bank. I don't know about Signature Bank. I would think the same would apply that you're going to have, because if it is true what Barney Frank said, who was on the board for Signature Bank, that they were fine. This was all driven by fear in their case. I would say their exposure to crypto probably had something to do with it. But if that's the case, then there will be a large bank that's likely interested.
Here's a question. Who approves the sale price?
No, that's what I think has to be.
Is it the federal government? Does the federal government have to approve it, especially if they've got liabilities in it,
I don't know if there is an auction type setting of saying, okay, where's your bid, and then you've got, because you've got so much in deposits that have to be covered, right? And so if they come in and say, and this was the news from the UK, that all right, deposits will be protected, no taxpayer support coming from the Chancellor there, Jeremy Hunt, in the UK. So if that's basically what regulators are looking at, but then I don't know from there, if it is like a bidding war, I don't know what rules apply and how they have to prove that. Obviously, HSBC, Chase, the major players, I mean, the big dog is Chase, but Bank of America is large enough to do that. These major banks are certainly large enough in terms of their assets to make this happen in very quick fashion. But I'm interested, as you are, and curious about that process. But basically, you're looking to assure them, because politically, they can flip that around. Then you can have Janet Yellen make the statement here and say, you know, just like Jeremy Hunt basically made the statement in the UK, all right, this bank will be, and of course, pending final approval, blah, blah, blah. But they do have to go through that approval process.
That would have to be,
any acquisition requires that approval process.
That would be the question I would have. How do you do due diligence in 3 days, or does the process take longer? We buy it. We have the intention of buying it based on the fact that these parameters will be
well, and that's set. You know, they have to provide the assets in order to make those depositors whole, and that's right. Kind of like, consider that their earnest money, but then it's regulatory approval, just like any other acquisition of between two major companies. But when it's banking, obviously it affects the exposure to. You know, I mean, if you look at it, Chase, when they took over Washington Mutual, my question would be, you know, I have an account at Chase Bank, but if I go into Chase Bank and say, well, wait a minute, I'm kind of concerned as a customer that you, as a bank, are now exposing yourself to, you know, their assets, and is that a risk for me as somebody who does banking with you and those kind of things? Which is why the whole regulatory approval thing has to happen. So, if you're going to have to obviously put up or shut up, and they put up those funds, and that oversight will be in place. And I'm guessing the regulatory approval process is expedited, and it's not like a merger. It would not be like that type of acquisition, since there are depositors out there that are exposed and don't have their money that was in that bank.
Here's another question people are going to want to get answered, and it's simply this: how come nobody saw this coming in the government? I forgot it was National Review or Wall Street Journal making the point the San Francisco Fed should have seen this.
No, you're right.
How didn't you see this coming? Because if you had seen it coming,
yeah,
would a bank have been more willing to buy it 3 months ago or 2 months ago or even 1 month ago when Jim Cramer was on CNBC?
Yeah.
This is a great stock.
Yeah, don't listen to everybody else. Listen to me when I say it's a great stock.
Yeah. By the way, here's a question. Is government censoring a good thing if it tells Jim Cramer to shut up about stocks he believes you should buy?
Yeah, right. Yeah. You know, here's the thing. I know you bring up the point, and I think it really goes to the foundation of what we have been saying. And that is, it was known. Everybody's been watching Silicon Valley for a while. There was an article, I don't remember if it was Wall Street Journal. I have to go back. But it was a month or so ago, talking about the mass exodus out of San Francisco from the tech people that basically created Silicon Valley, right?
Mm-hmm.
They were the ones who, at least up until recently, populated Silicon Valley. And then they had kind of, and we, you and I were, it was relevant because you and I were talking about a story where people were moving from New York and they were moving from other major cities, and San Francisco, they were moving out. Some of it has to do with the rise in crime in these cities. Some of it has to do with the cost of living and everything else. But nonetheless, Silicon Valley also was facing its own little, I don't know if you want to call it a recession, but fall, downturn, in that tech companies weren't getting the venture capitalism or venture capitalists that were funding their companies and startups and their operations. And as such, those companies that had their deposits in Silicon Valley Bank were using the money in the bank. So there was a drawdown in those deposits. Well, the bank had invested in other things that didn't go as well and couldn't cover it. There was a great risk. They had too much exposure in certain areas. I don't know about crypto, but there was some crypto exposure with Silicon Valley Bank, and they could not cover all of those withdrawals as those depositors were using more and more of their own money because venture capitalism wasn't working in their favor. I mean, they're... How do you not see that happening? It was going on for over a year.
Mm-hmm.
And where was the red flag? There should have been. I would think there would be red flags all along the way.
Well, you would think that, number one, just because in our popular culture, when Jim Cramer, you know, after the Meta stock debacle from last year where he was crying, that somebody watching it a month ago when he talked about what a great stock the bank was to buy, that somebody would have come forward and it would have become more popular culture because of him, and still silence. I mean, this caught a lot of people completely. Like, where are the stories on this? Why didn't anybody know? It doesn't happen in one, as you said, this has been going on for a year. It didn't happen in one day. Why didn't anybody see it?
Right. You had to have seen the hole in the ship. You saw the iceberg, then you hit the iceberg, then you saw the hole in the ship, and the band played on.
866-90-RED-EYE.
Hi, I'm Jen Loomis, a transport safety expert at J.J. Keller, and I'm here to share a tip on compliance, safety, accountability. Compliance, safety, accountability, or CSA, is the FMCSA Safety Compliance and Enforcement Program. Its goal is to hold motor carriers and drivers accountable for highway safety, and to reduce crashes, injuries, and fatalities on our roads. CSA does this by assessing the safety performance of motor carriers and drivers based on data collected during roadside inspections, crash reports, and FMCSA investigations. Based on the data that is compiled, motor carriers are assigned a score. The carrier is then grouped with other carriers who have had a similar number of safety events. Carrier scores within the group are then ranked to determine intervention priority. Low scores are better, so carriers with the highest scores are those that are most likely to be targeted for intervention by the FMCSA. Interventions range in severity and may include warning letters, roadside, off-site, or on-site inspections, civil penalties, or operation out-of-service orders. This tip was brought to you by J.J. Keller & Associates. Visit us at jjkeller.com.
Coming up, more with Gary McNamara and Eric Harley. It's Red Eye Radio.
It's Red Eye Radio. He's Eric Harley, and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90-RED-EYE. So, you know, for example, I read the Wall Street Journal, and the Wall Street Journal said, well, I mean, this is what happens when, you know, the government manipulates the interest rate for such a long time, where banks look for other investments, and that's what SVP did. I mean, they had way more deposits than money that they could lend. They didn't want to put it in treasury securities or bills because wasn't paying anything. So they looked for long-term assets. And then when you had venture capitalists start slowly pulling out their money, is, you know, as long as a year ago, they had to start selling, you know, their assets before maturity. Therefore, they took huge losses on it. Mm-hmm. Well, why didn't somebody see this 6 months ago? And that's why the San Francisco Fed, some are blaming and saying, how didn't they see this? How don't you see something like this coming when, you know, Wall Street Journal makes it sound like, well, this is what happens when you lower interest rates artificially for this length of time. Duh. Well, if it's a duh, why's Cramer on there last month going, great stock?
Well, and that's it. And also, I would say, but if you were looking at it, you had to have known that those low interest rates weren't going to be around forever. That at some point that was going to turn around. I mean, it's, look, hindsight, you know, It's always perfect. But there are red flags along the way. Big ones. Signature Bank's exposure to crypto. 27% of their deposits in early last year were crypto companies. Well, all right. So you're approaching, you're over a quarter of their deposits. That's a chunk.
Yeah.
And the crypto market crashes. You know, these ideas of, you know, well, we formed this bank to provide an alternative to the big banks. You mean the solvent banks? An alternative to solvent banks? Is that what you want? Remember Occupy Wall Street? We're not doing any business with the big banks. We're only going to do business with local banks. Wells Fargo is our bank. Because we couldn't, we were taking our time because we couldn't find it. Uh-huh. Whatever.
I remember that. They went to Wells Fargo. It's like.
And I don't have a problem with Wells Fargo. I'm just saying that they, you know, but those are the things you look at. if you're going to, you know, if you're a business or an individual, we all shop for a bank. You know, which one is going to serve our needs? But we also want to know that that bank's going to be there for a while. There are no guarantees in life, but you can measure risk.
So good, you know you want to listen again with our podcast, available on our app and at redeyeradioshow.com.
That's right. Listen
and
twice.
He is Eric Carly, and I'm... Don't interrupt me as I'm interrupting.
Okay.
All right.
I won't ever do that again.
Eric Geary here.
I promise.
Hi. Welcome.
But hello,
I know, I understand it's economics, and it gets you going.
Yeah.
When we talk banking and stuff. Let's talk COVID for a moment here because this was actually headline on Twitter. I think it was Mary Catherine Hamm who put it. Mm. Boy, the knot you have to tie yourself into. And it was Fauci on CNN. And how Fauci says the lab leak could still be considered coming from natural origins. And this started last week. Well, you know, it could still come even before Fauci said it. Mm. Start hearing the media. Well, it could come. You know, if it evolved naturally and they got it into the lab, and then it escaped from the lab, technically, it's like, stop it!
Yeah.
Well, we know that, but here's Fauci on CNN yesterday.
Here and on this theory of a lab leak, I've been wondering this. Do we have any idea how that would even work? Have you heard any accounts as to how that might have happened? Is there speculation scientific community as to how that happened?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Jim. So one of the things that people maybe don't fully appreciate, that all of the intelligence agencies agree unanimously that this was not engineered. Namely, they didn't deliberately do this to make a bioweapon. Everybody agrees with that. No matter what your prior thoughts were, everybody agrees with that.
All right, wanted to stop it there. Nobody is saying that.
Right, right.
Nobody is saying that, and nobody has said that. And even when Tom Cotton was asked it at the end of February of 2020, over 3 years ago, he said, well, no, I'm not saying it's that. I'm saying that it escaped from the lab. Yeah. I didn't say it was intentional. So they're going back. You notice how they're and they're doing this every time. Well, it's not. When was the last time you and I ever even talked about? I can't even remember the last time, a couple minutes ago, that we talked about it being a bioweapon.
Right.
Or a possibility of that.
Right.
But I wanted to stop him there because it's like nobody's arguing that.
Right.
And when you're attempting to stall and delay, that's what you do. You bring up something that nobody is bringing up in order to hopefully bolster whatever's coming up next. But here we go.
All right. A lab leak could be that someone was out in the wild, maybe looking for different types of viruses and bats, got infected, went into a lab, and was being studied in the lab, and then it came out of the lab. But if that's the definition of a lab leak, Jim, then that still is a natural occurrence. The other possibility is someone takes a virus from the environment that doesn't actually spread very well in humans and manipulates it a bit, and accidentally it escapes or accidentally infects someone, and then you get an outbreak.
Well, that's what they're talking about is number two.
There's so much in what we just heard. Well, even if it's a leak, it's still a natural occurrence. You know, someone accidentally let it out, so naturally it was going to leak.
Well, I like this one. The other possibility is someone takes a virus from the environment that doesn't actually spread very well in humans, or not at all. I don't want to add into it. Let me just read what he says. The other possibility is someone takes a virus from the environment that doesn't actually spread well, very well in humans, and manipulates it a bit.
Yeah. That's the other.
That was the point. Yeah. A bit. You know,
just manipulate. Just a little bit. Just a nudge. Are you kidding me?
And it escapes or accidentally infects someone, and then you get an outbreak. Well, the manipulating it a bit, whatever a bit means.
Right.
And the other words, doesn't actually spread very well in humans. Did it spread at all? Because isn't that the other one? The other possibility is someone takes a virus from the environment that doesn't spread at all in humans, manipulates it so it does spread in humans, it escapes, and accidentally infects someone, and then you get an outbreak. That's number three.
Yeah.
To take out a bit. But I just noticed you got to pay attention to the language when these people start defending it now, or start trying to come up with a defense.
Mm.
Then he said it's insane that anybody is saying that he should be arrested.
Mm.
This was I'm just going to read you the transcript here from Representative Mike Turner, who was on Meet the Press.
Okay.
All right. This week. I said Meet the Press. I don't know why I keep saying Meet the Press.
Yeah, this week. ABC this week. Right?
Must be because the logos sort of look the same. But Martha Raddatz is talking to Representative Mike Turner. I want to turn to the COVID origins. You said that you believe COVID originated from a Chinese lab leak based on significant evidence. The Department of Energy said it has concluded the same, but with low confidence. Why are you so certain? And then he has to correct her because he never actually said that. He said, well, what I actually said is I think there's significant evidence that lends itself to that, and I still do. That's why you just saw unanimously both the Senate and the House pass legislation demanding the administration declassify the intelligence community has with respect to COVID-19. It is incredibly frustrating for members of Congress to watch Dr. Fauci go on television and say things that are absolutely not supported by the intelligence. We're seeing the intelligence. It's not like we voted to say, show us the intelligence. We've seen it. We voted to say, show the American people. They're not getting a straight answer from Dr. Fauci or from this administration. They need to be able to see for themselves what has occurred. And I understand that Dr. Fauci has a reason to say that there was not a lab leak because he was actively working to fund the lab in Wuhan. So you see a gentleman who is biased. I think the public needs to see this straight. And then Raddatz said, I think Dr. Fauci would dispute that. Well, I think the evidence totally shows it. There is funds over which he has control that ended up at the Wuhan lab. At this time, you've got a guy who's going on national television, I believe, and I think members of Congress believe, saying things that are not reflected in the intelligence. So our view is show the American public the intelligence, and then you, Martha, you can have the intelligence in front of you, and the next time Dr. Fauci's on, you can say, hey, but the intelligence actually says X, and you can challenge him. The interesting thing is every single member of Congress voted to declassify it. This is after you and I cannot still find any major Democrat in the Democratic Party over the last few years that has screamed that the executive branch, the president, must force China to come clear on this. Maybe it's happened in the last couple of days, but this is how bad it's gotten since just a couple of weeks ago, where now a Democrat cannot vote against finding out the origins of COVID.
I mean, that's a 180.
That's
from nothing, from zero, to all in.
Everyone in. I thought that cannot be understated after they've been so quiet and really.
That's a great point.
No curiosity from Democrats as to what the origin is and, you know, why the government censored one theory. And now everybody's demanding that the executive branch come clean. On Friday, Karine Jean-Pierre would not commit to the president not vetoing this.
Right.
Now, here's what I'm thinking. The president vetoes it, and then Democrats join him and say, well, the president says there's things that we can't know in there, so we're going to go with the president so they can be on record as voting for it before they voted against it.
Man, that's going to be a hard sell. Because ultimately what you're saying is, sorry, we're never going to learn it because, sorry, parts of it are classified. Sorry.
Well, remember, we are talking about the Democratic Party that tried to paint Matt Taibbi and Mike Schellenberger as stooges of Trump and of Elon Musk.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So you never know what they might do. I mean, let's put it this way. I wouldn't be surprised if that happened.
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't be surprised. But ultimately, the American people clearly want to know where it came from.
Yes.
It does not get to unanimous that kind of political push from constituents, from the rank and file.
Rand Paul even voted with the majority.
He voted yes for the first time in 12 years. On anything.
I mean, now it happens to favor his position on it.
Yeah.
To begin with, but he still voted yes.
You could frame it. But that's where we are. As a nation, it is, and you're not going to, that sentiment is not going to change.
But when Fauci said a bit, it doesn't, it doesn't actually spread very well in humans.
And it just gets out to one person.
But isn't that interesting the way he phrased that?
Yeah, no, it's annoying because he didn't say that when he was testifying from the aforementioned, or in front of and responding to the aforementioned Senator Rand Paul.
No. The other possibility is someone takes a virus from the environment that doesn't actually spread very well in humans. So you're saying it does spread?
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they just manipulate it a bit or a tad.
So what he's saying there, hold on a second. What he's saying there is the manipulation was responsible because what do we know about how contagious COVID was by the time it hit the population. He's admitting the manipulation was all about making it more contagious.
Oh, yeah.
That is an all-out admission.
No, while still trying to downplay it.
Yes.
Because it was just a bit.
Just a bit. Just one little thing. Right. One little thing that made it highly contagious with humans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because being contagious is the entire, that's the whole ball game of any virus.
Yep. Well, it wasn't that contagious. You just manipulate it just a little bit and then it just leaks out. That's still a natural occurrence. If you're hanging out with Jim Cramer too often, dude.
But yeah, I thought that was fascinating. So And we'll see, because we played the representative Turner,
mm-hmm.
and we'll hold him to it. We'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yep.
We'll see if it actually does dispute what Fauci is saying.
Right.
Because what is the intelligence? Let us know.
Yep.
866-90-RED-EYE.
Lines open for your calls. 866-90-RED-EYE on Red Eye Radio.
It's Red Eye Radio. He's Eric Cronin. I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90-RED-EYE. We didn't even get into the story that came out yesterday that the president indefinitely blocks millions of acres of land and water from future oil drilling.
Mm.
That's as of today that they expect him to announce an opening of a huge part of Alaska for drilling.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, doing this way, he's trying to ride that tightrope where he can say both.
Right.
We've closed it down, and then no one will ask him a question, but you opened up here on the left.
Yeah.
And then on the right, well, no, we shut that down, but we opened it up here.
Yeah.
And it does go directly against his promises that the left remembers, that not one more drop from drilling.
Right.
And so this... The evidence is coming that he's running again.
Oh, he's running.
Because that's why he's trying to ride the tightrope on everything.
And he's the guy.
Walk the
tightrope. Everybody in his party. No, he's the guy. No, he's the guy. No primary challenger, he's the guy. Okay. All right.
It's amazing. It really is.
Well, I think they're looking at it and you know, who knows what will happen, but I think they're looking at it going, okay, and then maybe DeSantis runs, and if DeSantis runs, he wins. Or Trump runs and he beats him, or whatever. They're looking at it going, and then we just come back in 28. I think other Democrats are just looking at this going, look, we can't leapfrog over him. We can't, you know, get him to step down. We're not going to do that. We're not going to do a primary challenge. It would be horrible for the party. Just let him lose naturally.
Organically.
Yes. the way things should be.
Let him lose organically. Like that.
Just let him lose and then retire. Yeah.
This is Red Eye Radio on Westwood One.
John brings his skewed sense of humor. Jeff brings tips to cut strokes off your next round. Together, it's those weekend golf guys.
They'll pay a lot of money to PXG and Titleist and Callaway and on and on and on. Right? How many yards do you think you're going to pick up with that extra driver? I think I can get an extra 5 to 10. What if I give you 15 to 20? Can you pay me more?
Jeff Smith teaches on the sliding scale.
Those Weekend Golf Guys, the podcast, part of the Believe Network. Just search BLEAV on YouTube or wherever you listen. The Bigger Pockets portfolio of podcasts are worthy of your investment.
We're having a real conversation as real estate investors.
New episodes available every day.
It's important to buy where it makes money and not necessarily where you want to travel to.
Bigger Pockets, On the Market, Rookie Real Estate, or Money Podcast.
The purpose of flipping is to create more cash so then you can reinvest into other types of properties.
The Bigger Pockets podcast on YouTube or wherever you listen.